14. Stevie had entered a tunnel at Ellingham Academy before, the famous tunnel. That tunnel was wide as a highway in comparison with this one. This was a crack in the earth, too tight, too low, and much, much too dark. Stevie turned her flashlight straight down, forming a pool that splashed up the walls around her. Unlike the tunnel to the sunken garden, which was made of even brickwork, this was made of rough rock, possibly pieces left over from the mountain demolition. They might not cut you open, Stevie thought, as she tentatively felt along the wall in front of her, but they would rub you raw if you made contact with your bare skin. She couldn't extend her elbows more than a few inches in either direction, so she hesitantly reached overhead into the dark. The ceiling was only a little more than a hand's length above her head. And with each step, the walls grew a little closer. It was, in a word, unwelcoming. In two words, a mistake. Some part of Stevie possessed enough basic self-preservation to know that structural integrity and air quality were important parts of staying alive, and not being in tunnels was an important part of Larry not busting her ass right off the mountain. But some louder, wilder, definitely stupider part of her kept her moving forward. And it wasn't just because David had gone down first, no matter what Nate said. Stevie tucked her hands up into the arms of Poirot's jacket to keep from being cut, and numbly felt her way along, taking half-sized steps, and right into David's back.
"That's you, right?" he said. "I'm afraid of monsters. Also, it stinks down here."
This was true. There was a low-lying funk in the air. "The drone would work better," she said. "You know, if that's a leaking gas line or something."
"Did you just say leaking gas line?"
Nate said from above.
"Smells more like ass than gas,"
David replied.
"Tight, dark, smelly. This tunnel has it all. 5 out of 5 stars. "It's really okay to leave him to die," Nate said.
Then, perhaps remembering that someone actually had died the last time they went into the tunnel, he went silent. The space felt like it was getting smaller, and she wondered if they might get to some point where they actually got stuck, like people who dove into caves and their hoses caught on rock and they never got out. Except this wasn't underwater. This was almost worse.
"Now this is a Halloween,"
David said. Stevie could only see a bit of the back of his shirt. She kept one hand in the middle of his back as a way of maintaining pace. Now that they had proven there was a tunnel under Minerva, it was unclear to Stevie how far they had to go in this exercise. But if she knew anything about David, it was that he was going to find the other end of this passage. And if the other end was at the Great House, that was a good distance away. So they went farther into the dark, step by step.
"So,"
David said, his voice low,
"I've been thinking. Maybe we just need to clean the slate."
Stevie hesitated for a moment, losing contact with the back of his shirt. "What do you mean?" she said.
"Maybe I should give you everything so there's nothing left for you to snoop for. Do you want to know about me? About my dad? Do you want to know the whole deal?"
Now? Now he was doing this? In some death crack under the ground? But it made sense in a way. It was dark. They couldn't see each other. No one could hear them, not even Nate, who was too far away at this point. This was as private as you could get, and they were invisible to each other.
"Okay," she said.
"I don't tell people my dad is Edward King because he's Edward King, but I also don't tell people because it's pathetic. It's like every other dumb divorce story. But here goes."
Stevie wasn't sure if the sudden airlessness in the tunnel was her imagination. Probably.
"My mom was a concierge at a swanky resort in Marin," David began. "She did things like set up the wine tasting weekends and the spa experiences and golf trips. Edward King went to some event there, some fundraising thing, and he and Becky locked eyes. This was before he was a big deal. He wasn't a senator yet, just some local politician on the rise. My mom is very pretty, and Edward King is rich. It's not that Becky is just after money. It's more that she doesn't get that money doesn't make you smart. She thinks people who have it are Maybe not better, but more complete or something. I don't think she's worked out that you can be rich and have done nothing to deserve it. Which is weird, because she dealt with rich people for a living and should have known that's not true. She's not stupid, but she has some issues. You don't get together with Edward King if you feel great about yourself. It's not a solid emotional choice.
He paused, and Stevie wondered what was happening. She could not see his face or really even his back, but she could tell that the caustic tone in his voice was forced. He was talking into the dark because it was easier, because he could not be seen while he revealed himself. Even though nothing physical was happening, this was the most intimate they had ever been. No, she said into the beating pause.
No, he agreed. It's really not. They got married pretty quickly in some shady private ceremony in a judge's office, and I came out 7 months later. Eddie put Becky and me in his house in Harrisburg and went off to D.C. to continue his career. And that was the end of the romance. I was the result of the most consequential bang Eddie ever had. Captain Personal Responsibility paid the bills. I never really remember him being around much. Maybe at Christmas. He pulled us out to use us as props at a few things, but then that stopped. Becky was bitter and had nothing to do, so she started drinking. One time when I was maybe 9, I heard water running. I was playing on my Xbox, but I always listened. When you live with an alcoholic, you have to listen a lot. The water was running way too long. I went upstairs and the carpet in the hallway was all wet, and there was water coming out from under the bathroom door. Becky went in there with a bottle of Chablis and passed out. She was red all over. The water was turned all the way up on the hot side. I had to pull her out, then shower her in cool water because of the burns. She didn't wake up. So I called Eddie. I got his assistant, who told me to call 911, so the ambulance came. She was okay in the end, just drunk, minor burns. Eddie called me later that night and basically told me off for calling him and letting his assistant know about what was going on with my mom. I should have handled it. That was the night I decided that Edward King could fuck off forever. That was one of the things I liked about you right away. You also know that Edward King should fuck off forever. It's a good quality to have.
She noticed that he had slowed his pace. She kept her hand on his back and pressed in a bit, assuring him of her presence.
When I was 10, Becky got pregnant with a magic baby. It wasn't Eddie's. I mean, I don't want to brag, but I can count to 9. And Eddie was not around 9 months before my sister Allison was born. Her dad is probably this guy in the state legislature who went to Becky's gym. He came around the house a few times. I never remembered his name, so I just called him Chad. To his face. Right after Allison was born, Chad left the state legislature, and then the state. One does not simply sleep with Edward King's wife. Then Eddie and Becky got a nice, quiet divorce.
How did people not know about this? Stevie said. That he was married before.
That's the magic of Edward King,
David said.
He made sure we were gone before anything big started happening with his campaign. He married Tina, former intern Tina, to use her full title. Tina is a good campaign wife. She has great teeth, great big white teeth. It looks like she has a mouthful of kitchen cabinets. How am I doing so far with the full disclosure thing?
It's a lot.
Good thing we're at the end, he said, stopping. Literally, the end of the tunnel.
Let me see, she said.
How? I can't move around you.
Bend down. David squashed himself down and Stevie shone her light at the wall. There was a short metal ladder, just 8 rungs, leading up to a round hatch.
Keep the light on it, he said, standing again.
He set his light down, shook the ladder once, then climbed and reached up his hand, testing the hatch, pushing hard.
Nope, he said. That's not opening. A long, dark journey into nothing. But good tunnel.
He climbed back down. Stevie lowered her light so he would not be blinded. For a moment, they were face to face in the dark, though they could not really see each other. She turned her flashlight down to the ground.
Why did you decide to tell me all this? She said.
Like I said, clear the slate.
But why?
Because My dad has messed up everything in my life. Now he's making a career of messing up everyone's lives, but he can't have this. He can't have you. It sounds cheesy, but it's all I've got.
But your dad does have me, she thought. Could she say it? Tell him right now? He was reaching for her in the dark, his hand searching, landing on her shoulder, finding its way to her neck to feel along her chin. Tell him now. Tell him right now. He just told you everything. He ran his fingers down her jawline gently. Her breath snagged, and she leaned her hip up against the wall for support, which was easy because the wall was only an inch away. He kept coming closer, slowly, testing his way, until his chest was against hers and she did not move. The heavy flashlight was weighing down her left hand. She found herself leaning down to put it on the ground. Then she rose and reached for his head with both hands, intertwining them in his curly hair. When her lips met his, she felt something release inside of her, something she didn't know she had been holding. There was something frantic about the way she kissed him, like being with him was the only way she could breathe. They couldn't move to the left or right, so they stayed locked together. She kissed down his neck and he let out a soft moan, then a little happy laugh.
This went better than I hoped, he said. I thought.
Shut up, she said, kissing him again. He reached around, gripping her and lifting her a few inches off the ground. Had there been room, she would have put her legs around him. But the tunnel walls did not stretch to accommodate her desires.
There's something,
he mumbled against her lips. What? She mumbled back.
Light. Nate has to be signaling.
He set her down gently. She wished she could see his expression now, but they were blind to each other. He held her face in his hands for a long moment, saying nothing. Not kissing, not moving, not seeing.
Nate,
he said again after a long pause.
Nate, she replied. Your turn to lead.
She fumbled around, her hands shaking and her legs wobbly, trying to find the flashlight. Then she turned awkwardly. She was very glad that David had taken the lead on the way in because she had only seen his back. Had she had a good look at the long, tight way forward, she would never have gone on, and what had just happened would never have happened. They walked back, David at her heels, his hand playing with the tips of her hair, teasingly poking at her ribs, tickling the back of her neck. The world was perfect and hilarious all of a sudden, even if they were busted down here. It would all be all right. Her life had been building to this tunnel, this moment. She was warm and giddy. She was a new Stevie. Her light caught something on the ground. At first glance, it was simply more black in a world of blackness, but this was a different, deeper black against the gray, and it had a bit of shine. She bent down and reached for the thing, and David took the opportunity to reach around her waist and hug her.
What is it?
David said.
Treasure?
She held it under the flashlight beam. It was plastic. A bit of bag, shiny and black.
Just a piece of bag, she said.
There were no plastic bags in the 30s, probably. Probably? Stevie rubbed the fragment between her fingers. There was something. Something that clicked in the back of her mind. Her brain was always doing that, clicking and not talking to her about the clicking.
You okay?
He asked.
Yeah,
Stevie said absently. The bit of plastic slid coolly between her fingertips. It's nothing. The internal clicking got louder. There was a Geiger counter in her brain. Then she saw it. It had been hard to see the way they came in because it was on an angle. Another opening, about 2.5 feet wide. There's another tunnel, she said. She shone her light down into the space.
I'm ashamed of myself for saying this, David said, but we should get back up before Pix comes home or Nate seals us in.
Stevie took just a few steps into the new branch of tunnel. On the ground in front of her was another piece of plastic. She picked it up. It was the same shiny black plastic. Garbage bag plastic. That's what it was. Click, click, click. Her mind was going faster now, showing her picture after picture. Garbage bags in the kitchen at home. Her clothes in garbage bags when she came back to Ellingham. Garbage clothes. Ellie wearing a skirt made of garbage bags at the silent party. Up ahead, there was some trash on the ground. That's what it looked like, anyway, from a distance. There was a subtle sheen from more garbage bag plastic, then something formless, purple. She didn't have to go any farther to know what she had found. Interview with Marian Nelson, conducted in New York City by Agent Henry Evans, NYC office, and Agent George Marsh, Vermont field office. April 20th, 1936. H.E. Thank you for coming in to speak to us, Miss Nelson. M.N.
It's no trouble at all, none at all.
H.E. You understand what has transpired? I don't need to explain anything to you. M.N.
Yes, I know.
I know about it. H.E. You are the house mistress of Minerva House at Ellingham Academy, is that correct? M.N.
Correct.
H.E. How did you get your position? M.N.
I knew Mr. Ellingham from here, from New York. I worked as a secretary at his newspaper.
H.E. Directly for him?
M.N. No, for the editor-in-chief, Max Campbell. But I got to know Mr. Ellingham from his visits to the office. He was very involved in the day-to-day.
H.E. You became friends?
M.N. Yes.
H.E. Good friends?
M.N. Yes, good friends. Agent Marsh.
We first met when you worked at the paper.
M.N. Yes, when you saved Mr. Ellingham from that bomb.
H.E.
And he asked you to come and be a house mistress at his new school.
M.N. Yes, he wanted people at the school he knew and trusted.
G.M.
You're the only person from the newspaper to come and work at the academy, Miss Nelson. Just you.
M.N.
Yes.
G.M.
Why do you think you were the only one he brought from the newspaper?
M.N.
I suppose. I was the only one with the right skills. I'm not a reporter. I was a secretary.
H.E.
Did you have any other position at the school? Did you teach?
M.N.
Biology.
H.E.
So you taught biology and lived at Minerva House?
M.N.
Yes.
H.E.
Miss Nelson, we've been going through the files on all the faculty at Ellingham Academy. None of the other faculty members had a direct connection to Albert Ellingham's business life, not just the newspaper. All the businesses.
M.N.
Yes, what of it?
H.E.
I understand that was not a question, just an observation. It's just that out of the hundreds and hundreds of people who work for Albert Ellingham, he chose you to come to the academy.
M.N.
And you, Mr. Marsh?
G.M.
I don't work for Mr. Ellingham, Miss Nelson. I work for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I was posted locally to Mr. Ellingham. But he picked you out of everyone who works for him.
M.N.
Like I said, Albert, Mr. Ellingham, wanted people he knew.
H.E.
You must be close. You call him Albert?
M.N.
I don't know what you're implying.
H.E.
Nothing at all. I am making an observation, but I now need to ask Miss Nelson, and I must remind you of the serious nature of the matter at hand. Is your relationship with Albert Ellingham more than friendly?
Subject had no reply.
H.E.
Miss Nelson, I'm not asking this to embarrass you. I'm asking because we need to understand everything that happened at the academy that night. We need information.
M.N.
I know you need information.
H.E.
So will you please answer my question?
Subject had no reply.
H.E.
Miss Nelson, when you left Ellingham Academy, you took a train back to New York with several students. Then you went to an apartment at 1040 Fifth Avenue.
M.N.
Who told you that?
H.E.
It's not important how we know. It's important that we find out the facts. Is that correct?
M.N.
Yes.
H.E.
Who owns that apartment?
M.N.
The Ellingham Corporation. I don't have an apartment of my own right now. I live at the school. Mr. Ellingham let me stay in one of his properties.
H.E.
And when did he tell you you could stay at one of his properties? When did he convey this to you?
M.N.
When he told us we had to go.
H.E.
Miss Nelson, do you understand that lying to a federal agent is a serious matter? I need to point out again that we need information if we are to find Iris and Alice Ellingham. Without information, there is nothing we can do. Any delay in getting that information means we are delayed in our search, and if we have false information, we go down false roads. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Subject is visibly distressed. M.N.
Oh, God. Oh, how did this happen? Can we stop for a moment, please? Just a moment, please.
H.E.
Miss Nelson, I'm going to need you to be honest now. There is nothing to fear in being honest. We are not out to shame you or Mr. Ellingham. We just need to know. This is information that could be used against Mr. Ellingham or you. We need to have it. Is your relationship with Albert Ellingham purely friendly?
M.N.
You know! Why do you keep asking? Why do you keep asking what you know?
Subject needed some time to regain composure. H.E.
How long has it been going on?
M.N.
7 years.
H.E.
Does anyone else know? Does Mrs. Ellingham know?
M.N.
She doesn't know. She's distracted.
H.E.
What does that mean?
M.N.
She's... I don't want to speak ill of her. I know how that looks, especially now. But you have to understand, she's not like him. She's not serious-minded.
We understand each other. He can talk to me. H.E.
On the night of the kidnapping, Mr. Ellingham could not be found for a period of approximately 45 minutes, around 2 in the morning. He was in his office, and then he wasn't. Do you know anything about that missing time?
Subject had no reply.
GM.
Take your time, Miss Nelson. We're not looking to embarrass anyone. We just want to know what happened.
M.N.
We met.
G.M.
Where?
M.N.
We have a meeting place where they're building the gymnasium.
G.M.
Do you have any sense of how Mr. Ellingham got to you without being seen leaving his office or the house?
M.N.
We have a way.
A photographic copy of the truly devious letter was presented. H.E.
Have you ever seen this letter?
M.N.
No.
H.E.
Did Albert Ellingham ever mention it to you?
M.N.
No.
H.E.
When you worked at the newspaper, did you get letters like this?
M.N.
We got threatening letters, of course. Someone put a bomb in Albert's car there. We got letters, all sorts.
H.E.
Look at it carefully. Did you ever get anything like this at the newspaper?
M.N.
Nothing exactly like it. Never cut out letters.
H.E.
Is there anything else that we should know about? Anything at all? Anything related to Iris or Alice?
M.N.
Little Alice. Oh, Albert lives for her. You don't understand. He lives for that little girl. You'd think she was...
H.E.
Was what?
Subject had no reply. H.E.
Was what, Miss Nelson?
M.N.
You'd think she was the only person in the world. That's all. The only person in the world.
15.
David,
Stevie said quietly. Between her heavy heartbeat and the smell, she felt like she might vomit at any moment, but she had to hold it down, had to get some control over this.
Back up.
What's going on?
It's blocked, she said. Just back up.
No matter how calm she tried to keep her voice, there was a note in it that gave away the fact that something very bad was happening. He stepped around her to look to see what was in the passage.
What the hell is...
She heard him figure it out. Back up, she said gently. Back up, back up. This is how we help her.
Stevie!
There was a lightness in his voice. It was almost giddy.
Turn around,
Stevie said, moving him back, foot by foot.
I need you to turn around.
Now she was echoing Larry's words to her.
Turn around. Don't look, because if you look, it stays with you forever.
We can't leave her, he said. We're getting help. Turn. Come on.
She had to maneuver him back into the main artery of the tunnel. Her adrenaline had taken over. Somehow she knew how to do this, how to grab David's hand and lead him back to the end. When they reached the ladder, Nate was hanging over the opening, his wizard hood drooping around his neck.
Up, Stevie said. Move, move.
Nate backed up and she and David scrambled out. When David got up, he staggered into the hallway and bent over, half gagging.
What's going on? Nate said. What's down there?
Stevie shook her head, partially because she could not find the words, and partially to hold down the feeling of sickness.
What is happening?
Nate said again.
Ellie, Stevie replied.
Ellie is down there. Ellie is down there? Hiding? I have to call for help.
Stevie shook her head, and Nate got the message and fell back against the wall. Stevie pulled her phone from her pocket. David lurched along the wall and reached for it, pushing it down.
Don't. No, I have to call,
David said, pulling out his phone.
Both of you should go in your rooms, put some headphones on. That's where you've been. Play something loud. Go.
What?
Stevie said.
You can't have been down there, Stevie. You get it? Nate, you get it? She wasn't there. I went down there alone, just me.
What?
We're lying now? Nate said, to cops. You know what it means if Stevie was down there. I'll be okay, she won't be. All we're doing is reporting. That's all.
There was an urgency in David that was entirely unfamiliar. A high flush to his cheeks and a rasp in his voice. Nate turned gray as the wizard robe he was still wearing.
Just go in your rooms and shut the door,
David said again, his voice pleading.
That's all you have to do.
Nate swore under his breath but pulled himself away from the wall.
Are you going?
He asked Stevie. Stevie was not sure where she was. Moments ago, she had been in the tightness of the tunnel, in David's arms, embraced by the earth, alone in the universe. Then there was Ellie. Nate shook Stevie's arm.
I'm not going if you're not, he said. Tell me what you're doing. I don't understand anything right now.
David looked at her. His hair was still tousled from where her hands had been. She had kissed the fine smoothness of his neck. The smell of the tunnel poisoned her memory. David would be safe. Nate didn't know why, of course.
Yeah, she said. Go to your room.
This felt entirely wrong, what she was doing for herself, but entirely right for Nate. Nate didn't need this. Nate had been struggling enough with what happened to Hayes.
Jesus Christ,
Nate said as he went past them, tripping on the hem of the robe as he went up the curve of the stairs. Stevie gulped down some air. She started moving on autopilot, stumbling toward her room. She heard the first arrivals about 5 minutes later. She had put in earbuds but turned nothing on. Her heartbeat echoed back at her in her ears. There was another arrival. More voices in the common room, in the hall. She turned on some music, loud. She closed her eyes and put her head back against the wooden bed frame. When the knock came on Stevie's door, she actually didn't hear it at first. She had put the volume up too high. Pix eventually cracked the door.
Stevie, she said.
Stevie peeled her eyes open. The effort was tremendous, the light from the ceiling offensively bright.
Stevie, Pick said again, can you stay in here for a few minutes? There's something going on, nothing to worry about. Security just has to look at something in the hallway.
Sure, Stevie said. Her voice sounded sleepy.
Sorry to disturb you. Go back to sleep.
Stevie closed her eyes again and let movies play out on the backs of her eyelids. She summoned the feeling again of David's kiss and touch. There was so little time to savor it. The memory would fade. The sensation would be corrupted by whatever was coming. This had all happened before. The same, but different.
Pix returned and told her to pack some things in a bag.
Take your time, she said,
but her face betrayed her shock.
There's an issue in the house and we're sleeping somewhere else tonight.
Stevie got out of bed and began mechanically filling her backpack. Medicine, clothes, her computer and phone, everything shoved into the backpack until it squeaked a bit from the strain. She was about to close it when she had another thought. The tin. It would not fit. She pulled out a shirt that was taking up valuable space and put the tin in its place. Better safe than sorry. There was a security officer blocking the view to the end of the hall. Nate was sitting at the table in the common room, and Janelle, still dressed as Wonder Woman, was grabbing at things in her room and packing her own bag. Pix stood at the table, her expression grim.
Where's David?
Stevie asked Pix.
He's over at the Great House. He found Ellie, Stevie. In a tunnel. She wasn't okay. She died.
Pix waited for Stevie to absorb this.
Where are we going to go?
Nate asked.
We're setting up for the night in the yurt. They're going to bring in beds and we'll hang dividers from the ceiling. It'll be nice and cozy. We can talk.
Oh, good,
Nate said, picking at the table surface with his fingernail.
As soon as Janelle is ready, we can go. I'm going to get my things.
She must be tired of having her students die,
Nate said when Pix went upstairs.
Think of the paperwork.
When Stevie did not reply, Nate nudged her hand.
Are you okay?
He asked.
I have no idea.
How the hell is this happening? Didn't we just do this? I thought she ran away. Like she went off with circus people or something. Not that she was under us.
She wasn't really under us, Stevie said. She was kind of far away.
Oh, good.
You know what I mean, she said.
I know what you mean. I know that this place may suck. Two people are dead. It's not the school's fault. No, but maybe this place...
Are you saying this place is like cursed or something?
Nate shook his head.
I'm saying two people have died, and that's a lot more than the number who died at my last school. I know shit happens. Terrible shit happens, but this is weird terrible shit with tunnels and dry ice and people suffocating to death underground.
Stevie pulled her shoulders closer into her body. Her mind drifted away. It went to David and his story of his mom and his sister, of the promises she had made, of the coldness of the case she wanted to solve, and the coldness under the ground. Janelle emerged in a pair of fleece pajama bottoms and a massive fuzzy sweater, a silver overnight bag on her shoulder. She walked over to Nate and Stevie and dropped an arm around each. There were tears at the edges of her eyes.
Pix said Vi could come over to the yurt too, if that's all right with you. I'd just really like to see them.
Sure, Stevie said. Of course. Nate nodded absently.
David found her.
They took him over to the Great House. The blue door creaked open and Larry came inside in his red and black fleece coat, his walkie-talkie buzzing on his hip. He surveyed the group at the table.
We're going to take you over to the yurt now. We haven't told the school at large yet. Some people are still at the party. I'd ask you, if you don't mind, not to spread this. I know Vi Harper Tomo has permission to come over, but please don't text this to anyone.
We won't,
Janelle said. Larry's focus landed on Stevie. He was reading her. She tried to shut herself, as loud and cleanly as shutting a book. But people aren't books, unfortunately. The group made its way into the night, the two officers flanking them. The night was cold and still as glass, with only a sliver of a moon. Vi met them halfway, with the head of Juno House as an escort.
"What's going on?" they said. "Are you okay?"
They looked at Janelle closely, then thumbed away the tears under her eyes.
"We'll talk over there," Janelle said. "I'm okay. We just have to go."
Nate put on his headphones and lowered his head. He was checking out of the situation. Stevie wasn't sure which one of them led this movement, but it seemed that she and Larry were at a different pace than the others, and a fractionally different trajectory, until they were on their own little path together. Either he wanted to talk to her, or she subconsciously had to talk to him. Whatever the case, it was something she could not bear to hold in. As they passed the conference of statue heads, Stevie came to a stop. Larry nodded to the others to keep going. He leaned against one of the plinths and examined her.
"You need to talk,"
he said.
"I was down there," she replied.
"I know."
He held up a fake mustache. It must have come off when she was making out with David. She had forgotten she had been wearing it.
"What you need to do right now is tell me the truth."
Stevie dug into her pocket and pulled out the fragment of trash bag. She handed it to Larry.
"I found this on the floor down there."
"What were you doing, Stevie?"
he said.
"I told you, no tunnels."
"Fenton, Dr. Fenton thought there was a tunnel. I looked. I found it. It was homework, sort of. I didn't know Ellie was there. I had no idea she was there. It was just a tunnel. I didn't want to go in, but he went inside."
"David."
Stevie nodded.
"I had to follow him. I thought he might... I don't know."
"Did you find anything besides this, aside from..."
Larry held up the fragment of garbage bag. Stevie shook her head.
"There was... a smell."
"The first time you experience that, you never forget it. You can get used to it, to dealing with it, but it's hard."
"Did she just get stuck down there?"
Stevie asked.
"When she left the Great House that night?"
"That would be my guess,"
Larry said.
"We tracked up to the other end of the passage. We had no idea it was there. Goes to a hatch in the Great House basement floor that blends in with the other stones. She went in. Something blocked her way out."
Stevie's mind immediately went to the Edgar Allan Poe story, The Cask of Amontillado, about a murderer who lures his victim down to a vault, who is then shackled to the wall and bricked in. The horror of it was too much. Stevie inhaled the cool, clean air greedily. The smell was still there, molecules of it, clinging to the inside of her nose, her skin, her mind.
"What do I do?" Stevie said. "Do you have to tell the police I was there?"
Larry put his hand on his leg and tapped one finger. Then he inhaled deeply and let out a long sigh.
"Nate?"
he asked.
"Nate didn't go down," Stevie said.
"He's not as stupid as the two of you."
"He told us not to go. He stayed at the top in case something happened."
"Definitely not as stupid,"
Larry said.
"All right. This is about finding and reporting an accident victim. Technically, it sounds like David was the one who found her. You can't report something you didn't see."
This was wrong, but Stevie made no correction.
"If anything changes, then you step forward. You do it at once. You don't go in any tunnel here ever again, for any reason. You follow every rule down to the letter."
"Thank you," she said quietly.
"Don't thank me. This isn't about thanks. It sounds like you tried to follow someone who was doing something stupid, even if that meant doing something stupid yourself. I know enough about David Eastman to know he would jump in without looking. He'll be all right, no matter what happens. I think you know why."
Out of all the things that had happened, This was the one that made Stevie freeze.
You've met his father,
Larry said. It wasn't a question. Stevie nodded.
And his father played a role in you coming back.
He told you? Stevie asked.
No one needed to tell me,
he said.
That wasn't a tough one to work out. The sudden change of heart. Your parents work for the man. The sudden flight back, the fact that there are no flights back at that time of night and that you probably wouldn't fly anyway.
Stevie let out a loud exhale.
What did he give you?
Larry asked.
A ride.
What else?
Nothing, she said.
What did he want from you?
Just to be here. Because of David. I just wanted to come back.
She wasn't sure if she was saying this to Larry or herself. Larry let out a low noise.
It's not you,
he said.
Edward King is a son of a bitch, and his son is a piece of work.
She got the sense that there was a lot more he could have said, but unlike a suspect who starts talking and can't stop, Larry shut the valve.
So Edward King gave you a chance to come back if you kept an eye on David. Now things become clearer.
David doesn't know, she said.
Well, I'm not going to tell him that. This whole thing.
He shook his head and cut himself off again.
Could I see him, though? She said. He did just find his friend's body.
Larry let out a long sigh.
He's at the library,
he said.
They took him over there because there are too many people in the Great House. I'll take you over because of what happened tonight. But you need to remember, it's not your job to protect David Eastman. I feel bad for the kid, I do. But it is not your job, do you understand?
I know.
No, he said, I don't think you do. Don't follow someone into the dark, Stevie. I've seen it happen too many times.
Stevie wasn't exactly sure what that meant, but the general idea was clear enough. 16. There was a thick, fecund smell of dropping leaves that night as Stevie and Larry made their way over to the library. Why was Ellingham always at its richest at times like this, heavy with the smell of earth and air, extreme in light and shade? Why did the great house loom higher with its orange-lit windows, where the party was wrapping up and the school still unaware that another of its company had been lost? What was the problem with this place? Maybe Nate had a point, she thought, her footsteps hard and clear on the path. It was called Mount Hatchet. Maybe that was a sign. Don't go there. Don't blow a chunk of the face of this place and build your empire. And don't come looking for death and murder, Stevie, because you'll find it. She was definitely not warm enough in her vinyl coat, even with the heavy Ellingham fleece underneath. Her jeans were too thin. She had no scarf, so the cold tickled the back of her neck. Ellie, wrapped in garbage bags, underground. She could still smell it. It. Her. It. A few people trickled out of the great house still in costume. Of course Ellie was dead. Of course she'd been found on Halloween, sealed in a tunnel. It was distilled Ellingham, pure as one of the streams that ran down the mountain. It would have been dark for Ellie. Absolutely dark. She wouldn't have known where she was. She would have had to feel along those walls, going back and forth, looking for a way out. How long? For hours? Days? Crying, probably hyperventilating. Stevie thought of the depths of her own panic, the world-ending feeling of nothing. Ellie would have panicked. She would have gone back and forth and back and forth and screamed, banged, scratched and clawed. The thirst and the hunger and the confusion would have set in. No. She had to keep these thoughts out, paint over them with gloss and let them harden. She had a job to do now. Find David, who had found Ellie. The Ellingham Library was quietly buzzing. Several security officers were there, talking to the local police. There were no police cars parked out on the oval. They must have taken the service road and parked out back to keep people from freaking out. Despite the activity, the library felt like an empty cathedral. It had that strange architectural property of trapping any wind that came in through the door and spinning it up in a soft vortex that had nowhere to go. The higher you went, air whistled through the elaborate wrought iron of the circular steps and balcony guards, and loose pages trembled as if alive. The noise of the conversations below swirled all the way to the ceiling, smashing against the books. Stevie looked straight up, noticing for the first time the constellations painted on the blue ceiling. The stars were inside, closer. Larry had a quiet word with one of the security people.
"He's upstairs in one of the reading rooms,"
he said to Stevie.
"With a counselor. Let me see what's going on."
Stevie watched Larry wend his way up to the second floor and disappear into the stacks. He reappeared on the balcony a few minutes later and waved Stevie up. The iron rail of the staircase was cold, and each of her footsteps reverberated as she climbed. It seemed like the library didn't like this interruption of its peaceful routine.
"You can go and talk to him,"
Larry said in a low voice.
"The counselor said that would be helpful for both of you. But you remember what I said."
He guided her to the end of a wide aisle between the geography and geology sections, a row of green-spined books that concluded in one of the library's somber wooden doors with the gold-painted lettering. The counselor was waiting by the door. Stevie recognized her from before, when Hayes died and Ellingham deployed therapists in all directions. The reading room was a small spot, separated from the rest of the second floor by walls that were half-paneled in frosted glass. The original furnishings had been replaced with a gray love seat and four fuzzy beanbags and an equally fuzzy rug, just in case any of the other 600 cozy reading nooks at Ellingham didn't satisfy. David had avoided all of these options and was sitting on the floor against the wall, once again wearing the $2,000 coat. His knees were partially bent, and he was staring at his shoes. The counselor was hovering next to him on the arm of the love seat. She got up and came over to speak to Larry and Stevie in the doorway. "Would you like to come in?" she said to Stevie, in that professionally calm way that therapists have. Stevie stepped into the room cautiously, and David looked up. He was pale, his face all raw edges. "Hey," Stevie said.
"Hey."
There was a dry crackle in his voice, but otherwise nothing gave a hint about what had just happened. The counselor backed out and shut the door quietly. Stevie found that she did not quite know what to do with herself. Her arms felt gangly and useless at her sides. She wasn't sure if she did want to sit, but standing was getting weird. She considered perching on the arm of the love seat as the counselor had, but that was strange and clinical. After an awkward moment, she slipped down the wall and sat next to him. There was warmth radiating off his body. The room felt humid. Considering all that had transpired between them that night, there was no reason to be uncomfortable, and yet Stevie felt twitchy in her skin.
"They're setting up a place for us to stay in the yurt tonight," she said.
"Like camp,"
he said.
"Sadness camp."
He clenched and unclenched his hand several times on his knee, then suddenly reached for Stevie's and held it.
"Okay,"
he said, coughing out a humorless laugh.
"You told me not to go down there. I should have listened to you. If you say not to sneak in somewhere..."
Stevie could only concentrate on the feeling in her hand, the warmth of his palm against her skin, the message it conveyed. It was a need for her strength. The sensation rippled up her arm and was transmitted to the rest of her body in a wave.
"She knew,"
David said.
"About me. She was the only one before you."
"About your dad?" Stevie asked.
"We were a little drunk," I told her. "I didn't think she'd judge me for it. I remember we were sitting in the attic of the art barn. She was making a collage and she had a bottle of some German stuff that tasted like cough syrup and ass. When I told her, she laughed. She said it didn't matter. She could have told people. I know she never did."
David's voice was thickening. Stevie stared at the floor, the original tiles, with their scars and dings of decades of students scouring the aisles. There was a storm brewing, something that felt like falling and spinning. She wanted squirrels to come flooding toward them. She was about to ask David how he had managed to get all those squirrels when he began to sob. She had absolutely no idea what to do. Well, she did. The thing to do was to put an arm around him. Kissing him had been easy. This was pure and intimate and happening not in the dark of the tunnel, but here in the dim light, in full view of the books. She began to sweat. She felt the swirl in her brain, the speed of life. Her promise to Edward King mocked her now. Befriend him, take care of him, make him stay, make a mockery of every feeling she had about him to get what she wanted and needed so badly. She could no longer figure out if she had done those things with David because she wanted to, or because it was all part of the deal, the miserable, evil deal. Edward King had made her into a liar. He had turned her into someone like him, and everything that had happened tonight was tainted. If she touched David now, she would be complicit. But she couldn't leave him like this either. So she took his hand and squeezed it. She tried to make the squeeze speak for everything inside her, everything she couldn't say. He squeezed back. Then he fell against her in heaving sobs. Stevie bolted herself to the wall, unable to move. This outpouring of emotion was making her panic. After a few minutes, he leaned back, wiped his eyes, and caught his breath.
Fuck, he said. I'm tired of sitting up here. Let's go to the yurt of sadness.
He was entirely unembarrassed by what had happened. Not that he should have been, it's just that Stevie would have been. David was free with the way he expressed himself. He stood and offered his hand to help her up, then continued holding it. They were simply together now. Out at the end of the aisle, along the balcony, the counselor was consulting with Call Me Charles, who had been called to the scene. He had stripped the Charlie Chaplin mustache and hat and was wrapped in his normal black coat, but the strange pants and shoes were still visible underneath. Halloween was a weird night.
How are you both doing?
He said as they emerged. She saw him take note of their clasped hands.
About how you'd expect,
David said. Charles nodded solemnly.
Can we go to the yurt now?
David said.
Do they need me for anything else? I think they're done for now, Charles said. There may be some more questions later, but for now you should be with your friends and get some rest. I'll get someone to walk you over. Can we skip that?
David said.
Can we just go? It's not like you won't know where we are. I think that will be fine.
Charles said,
the two of you can go together.
David started to go, Stevie trailing along, linked to him.
Don't worry, Stevie,
Charles said quietly as they left.
Everything will be all right. We'll speak to your parents.
David turned at this, taking note, and then the two of them went down the iron staircase and out into the cold night. The stars were bright overhead. On nights with no clouds, the starfields over Ellingham were like nothing Stevie had ever seen. So many of them, so many more than she knew. There was a half moon, low and buttery yellow, casting a bit of light over the lawn and the great house. They were approaching one of the pathway lights, where a security camera perched above them. He stopped and stared at the camera.
The school seems to be very understanding,
David said after a moment.
About what? About your parents,
he replied.
Making sure they don't get freaked out. It must be hard to keep everyone calm when your students keep dying.
I guess, she said.
You must have given your parents a really good speech to convince them to let you come back,
he said.
What did you say to them?
There was thunder in her ears. I don't know what motivates my parents. It was a non-answer, and it did not work on David the way it had on Nate.
I was on the roof when you got back,
he said.
I saw you come home. It was late. I mean, I was pretty high at the time, but I know it was late on a Friday night.
It wasn't a question, and that was terrifying.
You guys must have been driving for a long time, he said.
I flew, she said.
Oh, sweet. Didn't you drive up the first time?
She had to open her mouth and answer, because every passing second told the tale for her. But how? Because the truth was now a confession, not a gift. The blue eye of the camera observed them coolly.
The plane is nice, he said. Did he try to get you to eat the chips?
Several seconds ticked by. Or was it a minute? Time was starting to stretch and bleed over the landscape. The stars crowded to hear her answer. Listen. Such a terrible word to start with, listen. So defensive.
I'm listening, he said.
She wanted to go back. Rewind. Back to the tunnel. Back to the kissing. Back to the laughing. Back to the dark. She could have told him then. He would have understood. But you can't go back. You can't recreate the conditions. David sat down on one of the benches along the path and stretched his legs out long in front of him. He crossed his arms over his chest and waited.
How did I not work this out before?
He said.
It was so obvious.
He smirked and shook his head. He came to my house, Stevie said. He was there when I got home from school on Friday. He was talking to my parents. He brought information about all of this security. He convinced them I should be able to come back.
That was nice of him,
David said.
And he said, come on my plane?
I didn't want to talk to him. I didn't want to be with him.
But you took the ride, he said.
Of course I took the ride, she shot back. I needed to get back. I knew he doesn't do stuff just to be nice. I asked him what he wanted, and he said, nothing. I just needed to be here because... Stevie couldn't find her foothold. She'd made her lunge, and now there was nothing. Just a smooth, slippery surface. David was doing what good interrogators do. When someone is confessing, you let them talk. And the impulse was there. She had to talk. He wanted me to just talk to you because he said you were freaking out and that was it and I... Would you say something?
Like what?
He said. His voice was cool. There was still a trace of thickness from when he had been crying, but all other emotion was gone. I don't know what you want from me, she said, her voice cracking.
What I want from you? Yeah. You've been hanging with my dad. Even you. He even got you.
A few more tears trickled from his eyes, but he laughed, hoarse and miserable. His every last suspicion of the world confirmed. So Stevie did what guilty people do when confronted. She ran. It was a ridiculous impulse, but it was the only one that made sense at the moment. She took off down the path, her feet thudding against the brick, but it seemed absurd to be running away in full view of David. So she turned to go across the relative dark of the green. Running is one of the most human responses of all. Fight or flight. Like her therapist said, once you start the circuit of response, you have to complete it. If you feel like you have to fly, you fly until your body tells you to stop or until you are stopped by an outside force. Stevie, not being a regular runner, stopped when she got to the tree cover on the other side and heaved a bit, her throat raw. She slowed just enough to hear if David was following her. Of course, he wasn't. David wouldn't be behind her anymore. She continued on to the circle of statue heads, the gossipy stone chorus that gathered eternally between Minerva and the yurt. She held on to one of the plinths and caught her breath. She had to get herself together. Think. Her friends would be at the yurt waiting for her. That was where she was expected. But she couldn't face them. Couldn't risk another encounter with David. She circled a bit under the dark sky and hated it for being so wide. Maybe she should call her parents and leave. No. That was fear talking. She had to get a grip. She needed... She spun her bag and opened the front pocket, feeling around until her fingers hit a small metal tumbler about half the size of her thumb. She twisted it open and dumped the contents into her palm. One small white pill. The emergency Ativan that she carried just in case. The one she never really expected to take. It was not a large pill, so she put it on her tongue and tossed her head back, and force swallowed a few times until it went down dry. It would take a little while to work, but at least she knew it was heading for her stomach, where it would be picked apart and sent to her bloodstream. She felt the need to sleep. Just put her head down somewhere, anywhere, and sleep. If not home and not the yurt, then... She pointed herself in the direction of the art barn, taking broad, fast steps. Upon reaching the barn, she tapped herself in and pulled the door closed behind her. She walked along at a clip to the yoga studio, a high-ceilinged, bare room with a mirrored wall and a bamboo floor. She pulled that door closed tight as well, and then, for no reason she could understand, grabbed one of the yoga straps and ran it around the door handle, lashing it to a bar. It wasn't the tightest security, but it was something. Then she switched on the light, assured herself that the room was utterly vacant, then turned it off again. Once you start doing something weird and you fully embrace it, it's much easier to get on with it. Stevie proceeded to build herself a tiny bunker in the alcove where the yoga supplies were stored. She made herself a thick bed of mats, which she covered in several blankets for padding and for warmth. She folded another blanket as a pillow. Then she stacked the rest of the supplies next to this nest, making a short protective wall around herself so that anyone peering into the room would see nothing but a small pile of yoga blankets and mats. She climbed into the bed she had made for herself, pulling several blankets over her. It was quiet and dark, and she was very alone. The wind whistled alongside the building, and the trees scraped the art barn roof. The yoga blankets were a little stinky and scratchy, but they were warm and soft enough. She took out her phone and wrote a text to Janelle and Nate. I am fine. Going to bed. Nate's reply came quick.
Sleeping where?
Janelle's followed a minute later.
You okay? Where are you?
She replied to both. Fine, going to sleep. See you at breakfast. Maybe she would stay here forever. Ellie. Ellie was a missing person, now found. Someone who had blown into the wind, and now the wind had blown her back. And David? She had destroyed whatever was there. She had killed it. She had murdered her feelings and his, but now all was exposed. She closed her eyes. She was so tired. Larry would know where she was. Her whole embarrassing path would have been visible. She would not be lost like Ellie. It was as if Larry alone was watching over her slumber. And that was the only thought that consoled her. 17. Stevie woke the next morning, which was a good start. When things are bad, give yourself a point for everything. She sat up. Another point. She was stiff and sore, her mouth dry, her hair definitely sticking up on one side. She felt a waffle pattern of yoga blanket on the right side of her face, and the faint smell of lavender and patchouli permeating her being. It was like she had been run over by a boulder made of hippies. She reached around, trying to find her phone and her belongings. It was stuck between some of the yoga mats she had been sleeping on. It informed her that it was 9:50 in the morning. Crap, she said. When she took an Ativan, she tended to sleep hard and a lot. People could have been trying to access the yoga studio, and she would have had no idea. She peeked over the short wall of blankets and mats to see if there were any angry yoga fiends waiting at the door to get their chakras on. No one in sight. She crawled out of her nest. You were supposed to roll your mat and fold your blanket at the end of class and say namaste and things like that, but this was not class. So Stevie shoved everything back into something resembling the right position and unwound the strap that was holding the door closed. Outside, she saw gray skies and there was slanting rain smacking into the windows. That checks out, she mumbled. She reached up and rubbed her hand roughly over her short hair, taming it as best she could. She rubbed any sleep out of her eyes and away from her mouth. She had slept in her vinyl coat, so now it had a weird flipped-up bend in the bottom. This was not a good look or a good feel, but this was something detectives had to do. She might have to spend the night in a car, or an abandoned building on a stakeout. Detectives were always rough and sleepless. Of course, she thought, as she pushed open the studio door, not all of them slept in yoga studios by choice, but she would build up to it. Outside, the mountain morning slapped her in the face in the form of the rain and wet wind. It wasn't pouring, but it was steady and cold. The sky was colorless, and even the brightness of the trees was dimmed. The day subtracted from life. The rain helped flatten her sticking up hair and slicked her coat. Stevie marched on away from the art barn. As she approached the great house and the green, there were a few police cars and vans, but the presence was subdued. "Hey," someone said. Stevie turned to see Maris coming up behind her on the path. She was dressed in a massive, shaggy black coat with black tights and red boots, and was huddled under a large umbrella that was black on the top and had a print of a blue sky and clouds underneath. Her red lipstick was the most vivid thing in miles. Stevie stopped and waited for her, even as the rain intensified. When Maris reached her, she tipped her umbrella at Stevie in an attempt to be helpful, but Stevie only got the edge, which made it worse.
"How are you?"
Maris said. Stevie shrugged.
"Holy shit, this is horrible,"
Maris said, producing a vape pen from the depths of her shaggy coat.
"I can't believe..."
"Well, I guess I can." That summed up the experience pretty well. You can't believe until you can. Then it just is. Stevie didn't want to walk with Maris, really. They had never exactly bonded. But to be fair, Maris was the only person who seemed genuinely, properly hurt by Hayes's death. They had not been a couple long. Not that they had even been much of a couple, but she had cared about Hayes. Maris had been friendly with Ellie as well. They were both art people. Maris deserved some sympathy.
"I haven't talked to you much since you got back," Maris said. "And now? I don't know, maybe the whole place will close down. But they can't let that happen, right? Do you know what happened? How she got down there?"
Stevie shook her head.
"I guess she and Hayes tunneled a lot," Maris went on. "They seemed to have a lot of secrets together." Did you really think Ellie did it? Killed Hayes? I mean, honestly, I thought you were wrong, but now..."
That's how it should have been. Stevie's idea must have looked far-fetched at first, until Ellie ran and hid in a tunnel for so long that she ended up dying in it. But as Stevie turned and looked in the direction of the great house, which was now a looming bulk on a dark day, her conviction was starting to evaporate. Maybe it was David's belief in Ellie. Or maybe it was guilt. Something was crooked in the landscape. She couldn't see what it was, but the edges did not line up correctly. Maris was still waiting for an answer. "I just know about the script," Stevie said. "That she wrote the end of it all. That she took his computer." Maris puffed for a moment and blew out a trail of smoke.
"If she killed Hayes and died down there," she said.
"Good." That seemed a bit harsh. Actually, that seemed a lot harsh, but there was a solidity to it. Stevie's phone started ringing. She pulled it out. The number came up as unknown, which was the first bad sign. "I'll see you later," she said to Maris. Stevie jogged off a few paces toward the portico to answer the call.
"Sorry to call at a time like this," said a familiar voice. "I understand there was some trouble last night."
Senator King sounded like he was in a hallway, with people chattering all around him.
"Element Walker was found," he went on, "by David, if I understand things correctly. Do I?"
"Yes," Stevie said.
She was surprised that she did not shake upon hearing his voice.
"Well," he said, I suppose that answers the question of where she went. Very sad, of course. Terrible, the poor girl.
Edward King sounded about as sad about Ellie being found as someone who had just seen someone else drop half a donut on the ground. Stevie waited. David had obviously called his father. Whatever was coming, she could and would deal with it. She could unload all of her anger, all of her confusion, everything. It was time. It would feel good. Everything here would end, but...
How do you think he took this?
Edward King said.
Finding the body. How did he seem? He won't tell me how he is, so I have to ask someone else.
This was not the question she was expecting.
Upset, she said.
Well, at least that's normal. That's good. He seems to be doing much better. I think you're having a very good influence on him, whatever you're doing. I'll make sure to put in a call to your parents today. Make sure whatever comes of this is smoothed out. Really, when you think about it, it means there's less to be concerned about. All right, we'll talk soon.
With that, he was gone. Well, Edward King didn't appear to know that Stevie had blurted everything out. Not yet, anyway. Stevie twitched a bit, thought of turning back, and then remembered there was no back to turn to. Home was still a crime scene. Or not a crime scene, but a scene. Off limits. She had promised Janelle and Nate she would meet them, and she needed them right now. She continued on to the dining hall. The moment she went through the doors, it was clear that everyone knew what had happened the night before. For a start, everyone was there, which was weird on the night after the Halloween party. There was a low electric chatter. Maris was with a group of people by the fireplace and chairs just inside the door. She wasn't sitting, though. She was standing on one of the chairs. Squatting, actually. Like a chicken. It was a weird move, like something Ellie would do. Ellie was gone. The new Ellie was taking over. Janelle stood and waved to Stevie from one of the booth seats. Stevie headed over toward her. Nate was there, and Vi. Stevie slid in.
Where did you go last night? Janelle said.
Camping, Stevie replied.
Where?
In the yoga studio. It was peaceful in there. The rain on the roof was really nice.
You should have stayed with us. Are you okay? Did you sleep in there?
A tray lowered itself onto the table. It was attached to David, who sat down with them. He didn't look up at Stevie. He just picked up a piece of bacon and started snapping it into pieces. The veins in Stevie's forehead began ululating in alarm.
I'm fine, she said. Are you okay?
Janelle asked David.
You weren't there either.
Great,
he said.
I'm great.
He snapped his bacon again. He looked right at Stevie, but her image seemed to bounce right off his eyes. Stevie felt herself vanishing, shrinking away. The toxic awkwardness of this conversation was obvious. Nate looked like he was trying to retreat into his sweater. Vi flashed a look of concern at Janelle. Janelle, of course, continued to face it all head on.
The yurt is nice, she said. They moved in some beds and they made little rooms for us with these tapestries.
Good to hear,
David said.
I've always wanted to live at a Renaissance fair.
I'm going to get some food, Stevie said, pushing back from the table. Though it had been some time since she had eaten, Stevie found she had no appetite. She walked along the counter, gazing into the amber depths of the warm maple syrup vat with its tiny ladle. Gretchen came up behind her, sliding her tray along delicately, careful not to touch Stevie's, as if whatever Stevie had was catching.
You guys are having a bad year, Gretchen said quietly.
I liked Ellie.
Me too,
Stevie said. Now that she was saying it out loud, she realized she really had. Ellie was goofy and colorful. Ellie had been friendly from the word go. She was ridiculous in her tattered clothes, rolling off the hammock chair in the common room.
Do you think she did it?
Gretchen said.
Really?
I don't know, Stevie said, sliding her tray along.
Sorry,
Gretchen replied. Stevie shook her head, indicating all was fine, even though all was not fine,
and moved quickly along the line. She grabbed a portion of melon as a breakfast gesture so that no one would ask her why she wasn't eating, and started the long walk back to the table. She had not done anything wrong, she told herself as she looked up at the judgmental faces of the carved pumpkins that sat on the eaves above. She sat with David in his grief, then she told him the truth. That was all. Did she do it in a kind of mean way for no reason she could work out after he bared his soul? Stop, she told herself. Just stop. It's fine. Just sit. It's fine. The space between her and the table loomed, stretching and shrinking. People turned and glanced up at her as she passed, some still with traces of their costumes of the night before, present on their skin and hair. Glitter here, smudged eyes there, colors in their hair. Stevie was about halfway back to the table when the cafeteria doors opened and a small crew of faculty came in, including Call Me Charles, Jenny Quinn, and Larry. There was the school nurse, the counselors, Pix, a few other teachers. They cleared a bit of space. They gave Stevie just enough cover to sit down next to Janelle and start shoving melon into her mouth. Charles, today dressed in somber gray pants and a black shirt, stood up on one of the chairs. Jenny Quinn stood beside him, quietly surveying the room. She was also wearing gray and black. Black crepe pants, low black shoes, and a massive, thick cardigan of gray wool that swept down to her knees. It was the kind of wild, magical thing that looked like it had come from one of Stevie's Nordic noir shows. She had pulled back her hair into a perfect bun that sat on the crown of her head like a donut. Her face was firmly set, and she ticked her gaze back and forth across the room like a scanner. She was looking for something. But what? Stevie had no idea.
Everyone! Everyone!
Charles said, holding up his arms.
Could I get some quiet for a minute?
The cafeteria settled in a moment or so. Stevie turned to listen. She could feel David looking at the back of her head.
As I think most of you know by now, we suffered a terrible loss. Last night, Element Walker was found. She was not, I hate to have to say, alive.
The air-sucking quiet in the room said that everyone did know this, but hearing it was another thing entirely.
I want to tell you what we know and what will happen next, Charles went on. It appears that Ellie suffered an accident and became trapped in a tunnel we did not know about, a tunnel that will immediately be surveyed and sealed. One building, Minerva House, was affected, so we will be working with Minerva residents on accommodations.
He shifted a bit and put his hands in his pockets. Jenny's attention was now pointed in the direction of the Minerva table.
The last few weeks have been a time of such sadness. What you need to know, what you must know, is that your safety, your health, your emotional well-being is what matters the most. We are going to be here for you. We're going to have counselors,
Nate mumbled under his breath.
You get a counselor, and you get a counselor, and you get...
Janelle reached over and took Nate's hand, and he stopped.
Every available resource. Some of you may need some time to visit home. We'll work to arrange that if you need it. You can come and speak to any of us at any time.
Charles continued burbling about procedures and feelings. Stevie shoved another square of melon in her mouth and chewed it slowly. Her mind decided this was nowhere to be and took a little trip back to anatomy class. Dis means apart. So many dis words. Discover. Dismember. Distance. All of it applied to her life. Charles relinquished the chair. Order was returned, and the cafeteria began buzzing gently again, everyone conferring about what they had just heard.
So is the school going to shut down or something?
Nate finally asked.
We hope not,